when I was growing up, I was always into computers. I ended up going to the University of Waterloo to pursue a undergraduate degree in math. And then I ended up tacking philosophy onto there. And while I was studying philosophy, I started to learn more about the brain. And in undergrad, I kind of had this goal of I wanted to be a professor. I didn't know what I wanted to be a professor in, but I just knew like that lifestyle of being the really smart professor just seemed something like I wanted to do. It seemed really cool. So I thought that's my goal.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm Tiffany Snyder, and I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hello, hello.
It's going to be a fun session today. We are here with Brandon Aubie of Q Reserve. Brandon Aubie is a mathematician turned neuroscientist turned entrepreneur with a lifelong interest with software and technology. He has a PhD in systems neuroscience, where he studied mechanisms of temporal encoding in the auditory system of bats, and then went on to work as a research technician and college professor. All of this helped to inform him firsthand of the problems faced by research institutions in managing workflows and personnel. In 2014, Brandon co-founded and became the CEO of Q Reserve Incorporated, a powerful resource management platform used by thousands of researchers, students, and businesses around the world for equipment and resource scheduling, project management, business workflows, and collaboration. Having experience in academics, teaching, research, technology, and business, Brandon has a unique perspective on the intersection of these areas, how they are changing, and where technology and innovation can play a role in their future. Join us in welcoming to the Digital to Learn podcast, Brandon Aubie. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. And to get started, per usual, we have some icebreaker questions for you. So we don't actually know if you're a musician or to what extent you love music, but the first question is, what is your favorite concert attended, assuming you've attended a concert?
Before you answer, Brandon, you need to know this could be a deal breaker, depending on how you answer. No pressure, just want you to know.
Okay, well, I'll craft my answer very carefully here. I do love music, and I love live music. I grew up playing piano, actually, and I have a bit of a background in jazz. And so I really love jazz music. And I can't say I have a favorite concert, so I will give you one of the closest concerts I've been to recently. It's with a group called Snarky Puppy, and they are an amazing jazz group. Like, maybe you've heard of them. And I just loved being at that concert so much because they brought so much energy to the room. It was a smaller, more intimate concert. But at the same time, when you watch them, you know just how next level musicians these people are and how crazy it is to think how much is going on at once between these like 14 musicians on stage at the same time, where they play off each other, they have different harmonies going, really complex syncopation and rhythms. And to think just how amazing this is being produced for you in real time, right in front of you, it's just extremely inspiring. And it was a great evening.
Wouldn't it be great if we could all get along that way and interact with each other every day, all the time, just like that?
It would be fantastic. Absolutely. And, you know, it was interesting. So I saw this concert in Toronto, and it was pretty obvious that a lot of people there were musicians themselves or were students studying music at a nearby college university. Because at one point in the concert, they broke into this discussion about the different means of playing this very syncopated rhythm and how the two musicians were playing off each other. And it went above my level. But the fact that that can break out at a concert was just mind-blowing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So that leads us to believe that you have interests outside of being the czar of Q Reserve. What kind of things do you do for fun?
One of the most fun activities that I've started doing in the past few months is something called geocaching. And what this is worldwide, there are millions of little containers hidden, and they are everywhere. They're at bus stops. They're in parking lots. They're in the middle of forests at the tops of mountains. And people walk by them every day. They have no idea they're there, But if you go onto the geocaching website and you join this community, what you can do is access the GPS coordinates of all of these containers. And then essentially it's this global scavenger hunt. And it's something that I've started to do pretty much every weekend with my six-year-old. And as proof that this is an absolutely fantastic pastime, I can be outside with my six-year-old for 3 to 4 hours on a Saturday afternoon without complaints. He loves it. I love it. It gets you to places you haven't been before. And it's all about the find. So when you get there, you find this little container that's hanging in a tree in the middle of a forest. And all there is a little piece of paper. And you write your name and you say, I was here. And you log it as saying, I found it. That's it. You don't get a prize or reward or anything, but just the reward of finding that and being outside is extremely enjoyable. And you meet some people who are doing it as well. And they say, oh, like I found 10,000 of these. And I think right now we're at 65, but it's a really cool pastime and it's global. Everywhere in the world, these little caches are hitting somewhere.
So could you at the same time create containers and then report those to the larger community?
Yeah, actually, that's a big part of it is people really enjoy hiding them. And that's something I definitely want to do. They recommend you spend some time finding containers first so you know what you like and what you don't. So like sometimes people will just literally hang something in a tree. Or sometimes it's more like a puzzle where it's like, go here, push this, pull this string, and then something appears out of a fence post. It can get very, very elaborate. Oh. And just the thrill of finally solving some of these puzzles is really a big rush.
And how neat for your son.
That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
That answer was completely away from anything I would have anticipated.
Yeah. The first answer too. This is just great. And I've got me curious. So the next question, favorite travel destination may or may not be related to your hobby there.
Well, you know, it's funny actually, because I've been to several places around the world, but I didn't know about geocaching until about 2 months ago. And so now I think back and I wonder like, how many things that I walked by that I didn't even know were there. One of the most interesting travel destinations recently though was 2 summers ago, so 2019, my family wanted to go on vacation and we thought, my son was 5 at the time, and we thought like, this is a great time, let's do something international. But we started to look at pricing and just the logistics of it, and it got really hard. So instead we said, let's stay in our country in Canada. And we went to the province of Alberta. And that just turned out to be absolutely amazing. So Alberta has a dinosaur provincial park, and it's exactly what it sounds like. It's literally a giant national park filled with dinosaur bones. And you walk around and you look down and there's a dinosaur bone. You can pick it up. You can look at it. They ask you to leave it there, obviously, because people study it. But there's just so much to do right in our own country. And like the Rocky Mountains were there, so we went for hikes. Yeah. We didn't go skiing. We didn't quite go that high up, but it was just a real eye-opener to think that we didn't leave Canada and it felt like we were in a different world. And so that was a fantastic trip for us.
Awesome.
Well, Brandon, it sounds like you're a guy who's always looking for adventures.
Absolutely. I don't like to be bored, so.
Our last question relates to holiday traditions. Do you have any? Do you have a favorite?
One holiday tradition that has been ramping up a lot recently is about, again, when my son was born. I should give him a name since I seem to bring him into this conversation a lot. So Colin, my son, we started to record, you know, like the home video. So obviously first Christmas, let's record him opening presents. And I've always enjoyed video editing as a bit of a hobby, nothing professional or anything like that, but just a fun way to spend some time. But over the years, we've started to make these Christmas videos a bit more elaborate to the point where weeks ahead of time, we are now planning story arcs and scenes and figuring out, okay, we need this phone from this angle, and we need that phone over there, and we'll put this camera here so we capture these different angles, and we edit this all together. So it's kind of become a tradition where on Boxing Day, the day after Christmas, I'm often in my office editing this video. You know, it started off as maybe a 5 or 6 minute video, and this year's, we were close to 25 minutes. This year was a bit different because everything we did was on Zoom. So we ended up recording a lot of Zoom conversations and trying to piece things together. And we had a neat little story where security cameras caught Santa coming overnight and stuff. But grown to be quite the tradition in my house that, you know, it's fun to make, but I think people also, it's going to be great memories down the road as well.
Please tell me your family has a YouTube channel or some kind of blog that people can follow.
You know, we post these videos. I just make them private though and share them with some family. Maybe someday. I'm not quite there yet. Yeah.
Too cool.
I would have to say that Brandon has distinguished himself as giving from beginning to end the best icebreaker answers we've had ever.
Absolutely.
Oh, great. Well, I guess that we can stop the podcast right here.
That's
right?
What I was thinking. We'll just end here. Cut. Well, we're going to transition now to some more serious questions about Brandon and Q Reserve. So, Brandon, if you wouldn't mind, tell us your story. How did your professional career lead you to where you are today?
So I was born in 1984. No, I won't start that far back. Basically, growing up, you know, I always really loved computers. I'd say I loved computers before we even had a computer. One of my best memories of kindergarten is the day that they rolled the four computers into the room for us to see. And so I always wanted to figure out, like, how do these work? I was always fascinated by computers. And at the same time, growing up, I was in a very entrepreneurial family. So looking back, like, my family ran a small construction business. My aunt ran a dance studio on their own. Now grown up, I run my own business. My brother runs his own business. My grandparents ran their own business. And it wasn't something I was conscious of at the time. But, you know, looking back to where I am now in my professional career, it's kind of like, okay, this makes sense how I ended up where I am today. So when I was growing up, I was always into computers. I ended up going to the University of Waterloo to pursue an undergraduate degree in math. And then I ended up tacking philosophy onto there. And while I was studying philosophy, I started to learn more about the brain. And in undergrad, I kind of had this goal of I wanted to be a professor. I didn't know what I wanted to be a professor in, but I just knew, like, that lifestyle of being the really smart professor just seemed something like I wanted to do. It seemed really cool. So I thought, that's my goal. I enjoyed math, but I didn't see that as a professional career for me. But the philosophy side started to teach me about the brain. And so what I ended up doing was coming to McMaster University to do a PhD in psychology. And that PhD was on systems neuroscience, so figuring out how specific neural circuits work with a very heavy computational component to it. So I went through grad school and I really enjoyed it. I got to do so many cool things, travel the world. I made computational models of how bats hear. I got to study actual bats with electrophysiology, and it was super interesting. But near the end, I kind of started to have this gut feeling that this wasn't something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. I know it was always my plan. Like, I'd say for the past 8 to 10 years, this was my direction. And I in no way regret my direction. I love that I have a PhD. I feel like, okay, I've maxed out that part of my life. PhD, done. But being a professor wasn't quite it. So what I did after getting a PhD was I actually got a job at McMaster as a research technician, doing some really cool things with computers and helping scientists solve different problems. If they would come to me and say, hey, I have all this data. Can you help me find answers to it or manipulate it? And I would do that. And then a couple of years into that job, the opportunity came up to start Q Reserve. And that opportunity really came from having seen and lived through quite a few interesting problems working with students and researchers at a university. And I decided, you know, working here in the real world is interesting. Having that steady paycheck is fantastic. But this pull to me to go out and start a business just was too strong. And so I jumped right in and I did that.
So growing up with all of your relatives having their own companies, I can imagine that was just part of the ongoing conversation as you interacted with all of them.
I suppose it was. I mean, I think the thing is, growing up, I didn't think of it as a thing. It was just what it was, right? So like, my dad worked for himself. My mom did the books. That's just how we lived. It wasn't like, oh, my parents are entrepreneurs, right? Like, that wasn't part of the language. It was just what it was. But looking back now, I kind of see, like, that's how it was. And so it's not like there was that steady paycheck every week. Sometimes it was down, sometimes it was up.
Yeah.
And in a way, it kind of conditioned me to know what that life is like. So I think it influenced me quite a bit to be comfortable with where I am and to get rewards from where I am, but it wasn't really part of the conversation necessarily.
So what was it like when you started your own first company?
I guess technically my first company was back when I was a teenager making websites for people. And it's one of those things where I had a computer. I knew how to make a basic website. Great. I have everything I need to try and sell people something. And so I started, you know, little companies here and there, making websites for people, doing online things. I started a sports website company in undergrad, actually, that took off quite a bit, where we had websites for sports teams all around the world. And even there, it wasn't like I planned this company. What happened was my dad was a hockey coach, and so I made him a website. And then a colleague of his said, can you make a website for my team too? So I said, sure, I'll just copy my dad's website. And there's your website. And then someone else said, can we have a website too? And I thought, okay, I should probably make this so it's a bit more scalable. And, you know, like fast forward right until grad school, where I exited that business to a friend of mine, actually. We think we had about 300 clients around the world. I had a salesperson in the UK who was selling for us. And that was the first experience where I learned just how fulfilling it can be to have a business. Mm-hmm. One thing that I've told people before is that, you know, like running your own business has a lot of very low lows, but the highs are way higher than I think you can experience if you are purely working for someone else, where, mm-hmm. you know, when we land that client, like that was all us. That is them saying you as a company are great and we know we did that. And that is just such a rush for me. It becomes addicting, I think.
Yeah, as you describe that, I wonder, for example, the friend of your dad who came and said, hey, could you make one for our team as well, a website? I'm guessing there are a lot of people in the world who, when asked that question, would say, oh, I don't know if I could do that. Not willing to kind of take that risk.
Right. Yeah. So I think risk taking is definitely part of it. The other big factor that is part of my personality, at least, is I kind of have this mentality of just do it. Like just start. Don't think about it too much. You know, if someone says, can you make me a website? My first instinct is like, yeah, of course I can do that. Before thinking like, should I do that? And obviously this can land you in hot water sometimes. And
sure.
To be honest, right now with QReserve, as we're growing and scaling, it becomes difficult to say no sometimes. And you have to step back and think, is this actually the right move for the company? But, you know, when you're 18, yeah, of course I can do that. You're going to give me 20 bucks? I'll do
that. That seals the deal. I'll do it.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
So tell us a little bit more about QReserve. Where did the idea come from and how has it grown since it first started?
Sure. QReserve is a company that, like I mentioned before, it grew out of me essentially living problems with my coworkers. So there's one moment actually I can point to where this whole issue arose. Universities have a plethora of equipment and resources on campus, right? They have all these labs, researchers, technicians, and all of them use equipment, often as publicly funded, sometimes as privately funded, but it's typically sitting in labs. And I was working, so this was after my graduate school career, I was working in this research lab. And one day we needed a tool called a microtome. And it's essentially this tool that can cut samples or tissues very, very thin, like microscopically thin. And we needed one of these tools that we didn't have. And so I knew from grad school, a professor who had one in her lab. And so I wrote her an email and I said, hey, can we use this? And she said, well, unfortunately, mine's broken right now. So I thought, okay, that's too bad. But we're at McMaster University. It's this giant research university. There must be many microtomes on campus, but where are they? And what came to light was no one really knew. I'm sure you could piece it together if you had email chains saying, hey, like, do you know someone, or some purchasing record somewhere, but there was no central database of equipment. And so the initial goal of QReserve was to make this information known, to make it accessible, so that when I needed a microtome, I could say, who has a microtome? And I can ask them. It doesn't mean they have to share it with me, but at least we know what's out there. Mm-hmm. And that was really where QReserve was born, was this idea that we should catalog equipment at McMaster and hopefully other universities. And the word reserve is in there because then, like, I would like to reserve time on your microtome, essentially. What happened was, as this continued to evolve, we found that that reserve aspect, we got lucky with the name, because that reserve aspect turned into be a bigger and bigger problem than we initially realized. So let's say I found that microtome and say I'm a student who's doing a research project and I want to use that microtome. Well, it turns out I can't just say, I want to use it at 3 p.m., let me in and I'll use it. This microtome could cut your hand off. Like, it's very dangerous, right? So let me give you a typical workflow of how someone might access a microtome. So say I'm a student. First, I would need some basic training, like lab safety. And I want to make sure that it's known that I have this basic training that university offers for working in a laboratory. But then I also need specific training that says, I've been trained in this microtome. I know how not to cut my hand off when I'm using it. And then I have to make sure that if I'm booking it on Thursday, that I have these in place, right? And then they're not expired. So for example, lab safety may expire every year. And it's a big liability issue for the researcher in the university to make sure that I am actually trained to use this. And furthermore, I probably can't use this for free because there's costs involved. So maybe my supervisor has to pay for it, but they probably want to know that I'm going to use this before I use it. So they have to approve my request. And then maybe I have to answer specific questions like, what am I using on it? How long will I need it? How many blades do I need? It just gets very complicated very quickly. And then, you know, we have more issues. So maybe I say I need it for half an hour, but what if I actually hunt out for 3 hours? Should I pay more? Who's going to know I was there for 3 hours? And then finally, at the end of the day, I've used it for my 3 hours. My supervisor has to pay their bill. And so what started off as a simple idea that we should have a calendar to book that microtome, it's evolved into a very complex platform that can handle a lot of very complex requirements for booking things. And we have every day 4,000 people at least log on to the system, students, research technicians, booking time and going through these very complicated process to access equipment. Therefore, what happened is we started off by saying, like, let's just figure out where the microtome is. Okay. That part, it turned out, was somewhat easy. People just go on to Q Reserve and say, I have a microtome. And then this whole other side has just really grown as a big need. And that's where we've been able to help grow the company, is by solving these problems that before were manual. And now we're becoming more and more important, especially in the post-COVID world.
It sounds like it would be applicable to virtually any organization.
Yeah.
That's what's interesting. So we really built this for research laboratories because they can have some very complex requirements, right? Like, one of them that came up early on was this idea that there's dark rooms. So sometimes there's a piece of equipment that has to be used in the dark because it uses certain types of light or something like that. So you might have a room designated as a dark room, and you might have three pieces of equipment in that room. So if you book one of them, we have to block the other two so that they're not booked simultaneously.
This has been a great discussion with Brandon Obby, but the conversation's actually not over. So we'll be back for part two next week, and you can catch it on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Podbean, or Pandora. See you then.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.